Hi, everyone. Welcome to this month's Safer Work. What are we doing? We are going to do some reading. I really appreciated everyone's suggestions on what they would like to listen to in terms of not Safer Work audios, in terms of Safer Work audios, in terms of streams, what you might want to watch or listen to. And yeah, I saw like a decent amount of interest in more reading because we haven't done a ton of that since I did my Dracula reading some time ago. And I was definitely very excited by the idea of reading excerpts or monologues or soliloquies from plays. I hope it's not too self-indulgent to just do a bunch of, you know, the best monologues. And but what is this all about if not me acting for you? So that's what we're going to do. And maybe we'll do a bit of, I guess, like, I was thinking I might do a sonnet or two. That's poetry. But yeah, I feel like there is a lot of like public domain theater works that I am reasonably passionate about, including Shakespeare, of course, but also like Oscar Wilde, Importance of Being Earnest is such a fun play. And so these are some of the things that are sort of floating around in my head. I actually think like when it comes to like just like monologues and stuff, I'm sure we could do copywritten works as well. I think that would be fine. But maybe that would be more fun for stream. Like if we're going to, it's like, I saw a comment on the thing about like maybe a like monologue from Succession or something like that, which is a very fun idea, sort of, but feels a bit more like fun and silly, you know, like some movie and TV monologues. That sounds like something that could be fun to do on stream with a bit of a looser and, you know, obviously like live audience could be fun. So who knows? Maybe that's more of a stream idea, but I think we'll maybe keep it to Shakespeare for today. And I guess I should probably give some context of like my relationship to Shakespeare, and that could be its whole other thing. But like, I do really enjoy his works, and I know that he's like the most, you know, hyped, like probably over, he's one of those people that's like so highly rated, he can only be overrated. Writers, I mean, he's like the most famous writer in the English language. And I think there's like a lot of really important work happening in like unpacking his work and like viewing it through a variety of like perspective and lenses that are not just like universal adoration and like kind of you know, deifying him as this like icon or like legend of a writing. Like I think that there's lots of great critiques of his work out there, and like just putting it in the context of like of the society and the time that he was living in, because of course there's much about his work that like does not reflect my values, because he is from like this, you know, hundreds of years ago and like a, you know, colonial society. But that being said, like I do find a lot like I'm always surprised when I read or watch Shakespeare, how much there is there for me to, relate to or like be moved by. And I think that's often because of people's performances. Like I think great actors will really show you what is good about Shakespeare. Not to say that I'm trying to do that today, but if you get the chance to see a Shakespeare production, especially like one that's more like modern, like with a kind of critical lens or like a challenging lens or an kind of unpacking lens, I think that can be really, really valuable and really cool. And how maybe they can be made more accessible than you would think, despite the language. And I think that like hearing it read or seeing it performed, especially seeing it performed, you know, really brings the language alive too in a way that makes it much more understandable for people. So yeah, actually, if you have trouble kind of understanding like the literal meaning of some of what's being said in these Shakespeare monologues, I really encourage you to like Google like a translation. Like there are these, like I think Shakesclear is a good free website that has like kind of direct translations into modern English that might help you. So yeah, if you're curious about what anything specifically means, and you don't get it, I would really encourage that, because I think that like it's just so valuable to know if you're interested. But okay, yeah, let's get to it. Yeah, maybe we'll start with a sonnet as like a bit of a warm up, since it requires a bit less like intense acting, perhaps. in the spirit of the month, that's the word I'm looking for. In the spirit of the month, I have picked Sonnet 18 by William Shakespeare. I think it'll be familiar to you, depending on your exposure to Shakespeare. But yeah, here we go. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometimes too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometimes declines by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest, so long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. A cute little short one. I really like it. I think it's fun how he like, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Is such a famous line, but then the fact that, like, in the actual sonnet, he's like, actually, you're nothing like a summer's day at all. You're actually much better than a summer's day, which I relate to because I don't always love summer. It's true. Sometimes too hot, the eye of heaven shines. It's really, he was speaking some truth there. I'm going to do Sonnet 60, which I wasn't as familiar with. It's a bit more like philosophical about like life and time. Compared to the first one. But yeah, let's give it a try. Like as the waves make towards the pebbled shore, so do our minutes hasten to their end. Each changing place with that which goes before, in sequent toil all forwards do contend. Nativity, once in the mane of light, crawls to maturity, wherewith being crowned, crooked eclipses gainst his glory fight. And time that gave doth now his gift confound. Time doth transfix the flourish set on youth, and delves the parallels in beauty's brow, feeds on the rarities of nature's truth, and nothing stands but for his scythe to mow. And yet to times in hope my verse shall stand, praising thy worth despite his cruel hand. That's another cool one. Because in both, you can draw a parallel between them because, you know, he's talking about the immortality of verse and writing, which is cool because, you know, we do know that Shakespeare's verse and writing did sort of become immortalized, which is not something that a lot of authors in throughout history have and writers have been able to do. And like, isn't that wild to think about like all of the poets and writers and just like artists of history whose work has been lost? Which is a shame, but also there's something kind of beautiful about that, isn't there? Okay, let's get into some dramatic and some other stuff. I'm gonna give the Queen Mab soliloquy from Romeo and Juliet, Mercutio's soliloquy, a go. Normally I feel like when you are gonna do one of these, you would like, you know, really prepare. And you would have really worked on it, which I haven't done. So I'll just do my best. But I do really love this soliloquy. And I don't know if you guys remember, like, from the Baz Luhrmann 90s film, but just, like, such an amazing rendition. I think a lot of people would feel that that's, like, almost kind of the definitive rendition of this particular soliloquy by Harold Perrineau. Yeah, such an awesome performance and super, super exciting. Like, also the way that scene is, like, directed, I think it's just a great moment and probably the best part of that movie, if we're being honest. But for those of you who aren't as familiar with, like, the context, this speech comes before Romeo and his friends crash the party, the Capulet party, where he meets Juliet. But Romeo is lovesick over this completely other, this other woman, over Rosalind. And so Mercutio, it's like kind of, you know, a party atmosphere. They're all like, you know, it's like dudes out for the night. And Mercutio is like making fun of Romeo and making fun of love. Also this kind of like dreamlike, like foreshadowing element of the terrible events that are to come later in the play. But it's kind of a cool, because I think a cool thing about Romeo and Juliet in general is that, like, except for the prologue, which spoils the whole thing, aside from that, we are like, it really feels like we're in like Shakespeare comedy world up until Mercutio dies, basically. For him to be the character that kind of hints at what's to come, even when we're in this sort of jovial, like, party scene and we're talking about love and like all of this fairy, like, dreamlike kind of imagery. So Queen Mab is like the queen of the fairies, and that's who he talks about, how she brings lovesickness to lovers. I'll give it a go. I think it's kind of challenging, but we'll give it a try. Oh, then I see Queen Mab hath been with you. She is the fairy's midwife, and she comes in shape no bigger than an agate stone on the forefinger of an alderman, drawn with a team of little atomies athwart men's noses as they lie asleep. Her wagon spokes made of long spider's legs, the cover of the wings of grasshoppers, the traces of the smallest spider's web, the collars of the moonshine's watery beams, her whip of cricket's bone, the lash of film, her wagoner a small gray-coated gnat, not so big as a round little worm, pricked from the lazy finger of a maid. Her chariot is an empty hazelnut, made by the joiner squirrel or old grub, time out of mind the fairy's coachmakers. And in this state she gallops, night by night through lovers' brains, and then they dream of love. Or courtiers' knees that dream on curtsies straight, or lawyers' fingers who straight dream on fees, or ladies' lips who straight on kisses dream, which off the angry Mab with blisters plagues because their breaths with sweetmeats tainted are. Sometimes she gallops o'er a courtier's nose and then dreams he of smelling out a suit, and sometimes comes she with a tithe pig's tail tickling a parson's nose as a lies asleep, then dreams he of another benefice. Sometimes she drives o'er a soldier's neck, and then dreams he of cutting foreign throats, of breeches, abascados, Spanish blades, of health's 5 fathom deep, and then anon drums in his ear, at which he starts and wakes, and being thus frighted, swears a prayer or two, and sleeps again. This is that very Mab that plaits the manes of horses in the night and bakes the elf cocks in foul, sluttish hairs, which, once untangled, much misfortune bodes. This is the hag, when maids lie on their backs, that presses them and learns them first to bear, making them women of good carriage. This is she. True. I talk of dreams, which are the children of an idle brain, begot of nothing but vain fantasy, which is as thin of substance as the air and more inconstant than the wind, who woos even now the frozen bosom of the north, and being angered, puffs away from thence, turning his face to the dew-dropping south. That's such a fun one. It's one of my favorites. I think it's interesting. Like, I think there's some people who speculate that Mercutio himself has some war trauma. Because, like, when he gets to that bit about the soldier and what happens to the soldier when Queen Mab visits him in the night, that's a very interesting turn where he's talking about, you know, PTSD dreams. And it's quite interesting to think that that might be personal for Mercutio, and that's why it kind of bubbles up. It feels very true to Mercutio's character and kind of the way that it does feel like the kind of facade that he puts on. Like, he's a bit of a clown in some ways, but he has this, like, also, he's very angry, like, he's very impulsive, and, like, it seems consistent with his psychology that he has this trauma that's, like, kind of only barely veiled by the kind of persona that he puts on. And it's interesting, like, it feels very true that, like, especially on, like, a night out with his friends, and maybe they've been drinking and stuff, that, like, it doesn't take much for him to go to, like, woo, like, dreams and fairies and love, and then, like, for it to get kind of dark. And so he gets interrupted at the end of the soliloquy by Romeo saying, peace, peace, Mercutio, peace, thou talkst of nothing. And then he has that little afterword, but it's a good one. Okay, next I'm going to try one of Benedick's monologues from Much Ado About Nothing, also by Shakespeare. There's a movie of this with Denzel Washington and Keanu and stuff, which is cool. And Emma Thompson, I think. And so it's Emma Thompson and Kenneth Branagh as Beatrice and Benedict, who, like, I don't want to say they're definitely not the original, like, quarreling lovers, like enemies to lovers, but they are definitely an example. They're a classic example of enemies to lovers, where, like, oh, they hate each other and they're always quarreling and they're both kind of quick-witted and they're both like, I'm never going to get married. Blah, 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 blah. And then they get parent trapped, basically. That's what happens in Much Ado. So this is after Benedict has been tricked by, two of his friends have tricked him so that, like, they know that he's spying on them, basically, while they have this private conversation, which, of course, they know that he's watching them, and they're talking about how Beatrice is in love with Benedict, and oh, poor Beatrice, because Benedict will never feel that way about her, and, like, why would she be in love with such a shitty guy, and they're kind of giving him a hard time, because they know that he's watching, and, of course, trying to make him think, like, whoa, wait, Beatrice is in love with me, which, of course, makes him realize his feelings for her. So, yeah. And, like, the first line of this, I think, is especially kind of funny because, like, you know, we, the audience, are in on the joke. So we are, it's kind of funny how clueless Benedict is that this is actually, that he's been tricked. So this is Benedict, like, emerging from his hiding place after. This can be no trick. The conference was sadly born. They have the truth of this from Hero. They seem to pity the lady. Seems her affections have their full bent. Love me. Why, it must be requited. I hear how I am censured. They say I will bear myself proudly if I perceive the love came from her. They say, too, that she will rather die than give any sign of affection. I did never think to marry. I must not seem proud. Happy are they that can hear their detractions and can put them to mending. They say the lady is fair. 'Tis the truth, I can bear them witness. And virtuous, 'tis so, I cannot reprove it. And wise, but for loving me. By my troth, it is no addition to her wit, no more great argument of her folly, for I will be horribly in love with her. I may chance have some odd quirks and remnants of wit broken on me because I have railed so long against marriage, but doth not the appetite alter? A man loves the meat in his youth that he cannot endure in his age. Shall quips and sentences and these paper bullets of the brain awe a man from the career of his humor? No! The world must be peopled. When I say I would die a bachelor, I did not think I should live till I were married. Oh, here comes Beatrice. By this day, she's a fair lady. I do spy some marks of love in her. Okay, and now for something completely different. I think I'm going to do a Hamlet. I think I'm going to do Mandelite's Not Me, or What a Piece of Work Is Man. It's a soliloquy where Hamlet, like in a lot of Hamlet, is very sad, and where he kind of explains what he's been going through to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who are two of his friends who have actually been sent to spy on him. But it's probably my favorite Hamlet bit, or one of. Obviously, there's to be or not to be, but I don't want to do that. Okay. I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, forgone all custom of exercises, and indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire, why, it appeareth nothing to me but a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors. What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action how like an angel, in apprehension how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet to me what is this quintessence of dust? Mandelite's Not Me. No, nor women neither, though by your smiling you seem to say so. Kind of a funny bit at the end there where, like, Rosencrantz undercuts Hamlet's soliloquy by being like, hee hee hee. Oh, man doesn't delight you, so you're not gay. Yeah, there's the next two lines are funny because Rosencrantz says, that's what Hamlet's talking to Rosencrantz when he says, nor women neither, though by your smiling you seem to say so. And Rosencrantz goes, my lord, there is no such stuff in my thoughts. And Hamlet says, why did you laugh then when I said man delights not me? That's a fun bit. Ooh, yeah, I think we'll do some villainous stuff. I think I'll do an Iago soliloquy from, so how many times do I mess this up in this audio? Soliloquy from Othello, which is one of my favorite Shakespearean tragedies. And so this is, and Iago is like my favorite Shakespeare villain. He's so awful. He's like kind of satanic in his own way. And cause like, but it's cool that the play gives him, like we really get to see inside his head, which feels kind of unique among Shakespearean villains, to an extent, like he has multiple soliloquies. And so this, I'm going to do, his, speech from Act 2, Scene 3, where he's talking about what his plan is. Trick Othello into believing that his wife Desdemona has been unfaithful to him, and basically destroy both of their lives. For no, like, real reason, and that's an interesting thing about Iago, too, is that, like, in his soliloquies, he's like, why am I doing this? Is it for the, like, he kind of provides some reasons. Like, he's like, I got passed over for a promotion by Othello. Is that why I'm doing it? Meh. He's just kind of an evil dude. He hates goodness. And yeah, he just like, he can't stand. So specifically, Iago has just given Cassio the advice to go to Desdemona to try to get his rank back, because Iago basically got Cassio drunk, provoked him into a brawl with this other guy. And then Othello, who's like their superior officer, stripped Cassio of his rank. So, Iago has advised Cassio to go to Desdemona and get Desdemona to basically like plead with Othello for leniency. And this is all part of Iago's plan because he's trying to make Othello think that Desdemona is cheating on him with Cassio. So he's setting all this up. So it seems like Desdemona is arguing for Cassio because they're lovers. So I hope that gives some context on this, on the specificity of this. And what's he then that says I play the villain? When this advice is free, I give, and honest, probable to thinking, and indeed the course to win the moor again. For 'tis most easy, the inclining Desdemona to subdue in any honest suit. She's framed as fruitful as the free elements, and then for her to win the moor, were it to renounce his baptism, all seals and symbols of redeemed sin, his soul is so enfettered to her love that she may make, unmake, do what she list, even as her appetite shall play the god with his weak function. How am I then a villain to counsel Cassio to this parallel course directly to his good? Divinity of hell, when devils shall the blackest sins put on, they do suggest at first with heavenly shows, as I do now. For whiles this honest fool plies Desdemona to repair his fortune, and she for him pleads strongly to the moor, I'll pour this pestilence into his ear, that she repeals him for her body's lust, and by how much she strives to do him good, she shall undo her credit with the moor. So will I turn her virtue into pitch, and out of her own goodness make the net that shall enmesh them all. Iago, what a bastard. And ever since I first read Othello, I was sort of captured by him. And I think I'm going to finish up with Romeo. It's like the most cliche monologue ever, maybe. But yeah, it's a classic, and I do like it. And I feel like, yeah, I want to end with something. Yeah, something sweet and soft. So, okay. Here we go. But soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon, who is already sick and pale with grief that thou, her maid, art far more fair than she. Be not her maid, since she is envious, Her vestal livery is but sick and green, and none but fools do wear it. Cast it off. It is my lady. Oh, it is my love. Oh, that she knew she were. She speaks, yet she says nothing. What of that? Her eye discourses. I will answer it. Oh, I'm too bold. 'Tis not to me she speaks. Two of the fairest stars in all the heaven, having some business, do entreat her eyes to twinkle in their spheres till they return. What if her eyes were there and they in her head? The brightness of her cheek would shame those stars, as daylight doth a lamp. Her eyes in heaven would through the airy region stream so bright that birds would sing and think it were not night. See how she leans her cheek upon her hand. Oh, that I were a glove upon that hand, that I might touch that cheek. Yeah, that one's actually better than I remember. The bit about, like, exchanging eyes. And it's kind of funny, too. Like, it's a little silly and sweet. And so I think it's a nice one to end on. But yeah, I will see you, perhaps, on Tuesday for the stream. I'm quite excited. Again, there's just like so many possibilities, so I don't quite know what we're going to do. But I'm excited. Yeah, I think it's going to be fun. So I hope you can join us. And yeah, I do really enjoy reading. And I think it's like, it seems like there's interest. So I would love to do more of this in SaferWorks or on stream. Yeah, hopefully it's kind of a nice mix of like chatty and relaxing in its own way. But yeah. Take care and have a good one, and I will see you very soon. Bye.